This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, President Bush addresses reporters and doesn't quite say whether he'll increase U.S. forces in Iraq. And Cleveland area Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones will head the House Ethics Committee. Joining us, Julianne Malveaux, an economist and head of Last Word Productions. She's in Washington. Bob Meadows of People Magazine and Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of NorthStarNetwork.com. They are both in New York. Hello, everybody.
Morning.
Hi.
Good day.
Listen, before we get to our main topics, as we often do on this program, I want to just very, very briefly go back to the issue that we addressed in the A segment about this victimizing issue, because I think about this quite a bit myself. And I'm wondering, do you think or do you see yourselves as victims? I mean, in your case, Julianne, it's really hard for me to imagine you seeing yourself as a victim.
I see myself as a conqueror, frankly. Victim, no victor. However, from a historical context, clearly our people collectively have been victimized, and it amuses me when I hear people like your first guest talk about the trauma of victimization, understanding, as Professor West said, the historical trauma that African-American people have had to deal with and continue to deal with when something like Sean Bell gets shot in the back occurs. Still, many of us lead successful, fulfilled lives, and we're victors over the institutional racism that perhaps shackles so many of our other people in our community.
So, Bob, do you or Walter, do you ever grapple with the idea of whether you consider yourself a victim?
Well, you know, I make the distinction between being victimized and this notion of being a victim, because to be a victim, something happened to you, and sort of the distinction I make from between being a slave and being enslaved. And I think it's important for us to understand that, you know, if you see yourself as a victim, you're sort of accepting the conditions of victimization, and that it's important for us to understand that although something may have happened to us individually or as a group, you know, we have the ability to overcome that. So I think for African Americans, the notion of being victims, I find to be, you know, I don't agree with. I think we've been victimized. Mm-hmm. We have been, you know, the object of hate. We've been the object of scorn. But as a people, we can overcome that.
I have to agree with Walter and with Julianne, because I feel like a victim is someone who has given up. If that's how you view yourself, I'm a victim. You've given up on everything, and you really don't see that you have any outlook, and you may very well just stop trying. Sure, as we've all been victimized, we are subject to the whims often of the majority in this country. But no, black people do not give up, and I consider myself actually to be an optimist.
All right, that's good. Let's move on to another topic here. President Bush, as we all know, held a news conference yesterday. But what I'd like to talk about with the three of you today is the president and the media, who've had a contentious six-year relationship. Now, we know the headlines coming out of yesterday's news conference, the issue of troop buildup, which potentially pits the commander-in-chief, Bush, against the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So here is a direct question to Bush by a reporter yesterday and the president's response. Listen to this.
If you conclude that a surge in troop levels in Iraq is needed, would you overrule your military commanders if they felt it was not a good idea?
That's a dangerous hypothetical question. I'm not condemning you. You're allowed to ask anything you want. Let me wait and gather all the recommendations from Bob Gates, from our military, from diplomats on the ground. That's interested in the Iraqis' point of view. And then I'll report back to you as to whether or not I support a surge or not. Nice try.
So what do you make of this, Walter, the president's demeanor in answering these reporters? And do you see any change in his relationship with the press?
Well, you see, I have to disagree with you. I don't think there's been a contentious relationship between the press and this White House. Up until a year ago, the press really embraced the Bush administration. Remember, they were complicit in the march to war. They accepted this notion of having embeds and being close to the military and really not questioning any of the Bush administration's moves as we went to Iraq. What's happening now is that the press is catching up with the American public and finally beginning to ask some hard questions. And this president has no answers, because he has no solutions. So I think what I'm waiting for is this press conference when Mr. Bush comes out and explains his new vision for Iraq, because I think the American public is going to be not only deeply disappointed, but extremely angry when they hear it.
Really, Bob, you share that view?
I know when I covered the 2000 election, all the reporters on Bush's bus really liked him a lot. None of the reporters on, or few of the reporters on Al Gore's bus actually cared for him all that much. Bush was a very folksy guy, and as Walter said, that won him a lot of cachet, I guess, with the reporters for a long, long time as far as him on a personal level. But yeah, now that after 3 years of this war, it's gone on longer, if you can believe it, than World War II. And just this muck and mire that we're stuck in. The Democrats have come back. They've made there's been a sea change in the country. So, of course, the media is following that. So now they feel, ever since Anderson Cooper went off on that politician back mm-hmm. in Katrina, mm-hmm. the media feels that, hey, now we can all step up because they all probably want to be like Anderson Cooper and get their own show. But they feel like, hey, we can now go after these people and be emotion and not just be these automatons and just accept what this man is saying.
Well, what's your take, Julianne?
You know, I don't think that the relationship has been contentious at all. I mean, I think there have been a couple of people in the press corps who have pushed. And I think there have been some people like Keith Olbermann, who has been absolutely phenomenal in being a critic. But I really don't think that, by and large, I mean, as Walter said, the press was complicit. This fiction of weapons of mass distraction was completely accepted by most of the media. Now, the challenge right now is that this president wants to do multiple choice foreign policy. He didn't like what the Iraq study group said, so, you know, okay. You know, let's see what somebody else has to say. So, you know, the woman asked a question about would he overrule the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and we've already had a major resignation. What that press conference, the impression I had yesterday was that this man did not learn any lessons at all. I mean, he comes out and says, oh, yeah, we're going to win this. Well, how? You know, put yourself a jacket on, dude, and go see what you can do. Because, in fact, we're not going to win this one. It's more complicated than Vietnam. As Bob says, it's longer than World War II. And we are losing young people and not so young people who don't have a dog in this fight. Thousands, you know, maimed in most horrible ways. And he's sitting there like, you know, the kid who aced the exam saying, you know, nice try. Mm-hmm. You know?
So none of you think then that the, for example, the resignation, the announced resignation of General Abizaid is going to change anything with regard to the president's approach to a strategy, an exit strategy, if there is to be one for Iraq?
I think pressure is going to have to come from Congress. I think that, mm-hmm. you know, where you have seen the sea change, as has one of my colleagues mentioned, has been in the 2006 elections. However, the problem is that the Democrats are not organized. You know, the Republicans are not bright and the Democrats are not organized. And that's a fatal combination. But the pressure is going to have to come from the Congress to push him on a change in strategy. It's not going to come. He's ignoring his generals. He's been ignoring them for months.
It's astonishing to me, but this is actually Bush, very consistent. He has remained stubborn on every single issue, no matter what information has been put in front of him. And this is just another case. He is holding the line because that's just how he is. It's not going to change.
Well, I think the pressure is going to come from within his own party, because I think his own party is extremely angry because, unbeknownst to many of the public, a lot of Republicans really are angry because, particularly members of Congress, because mm-hmm. they were lied to. Mm-hmm. They accepted the president's word on much of this war. And I think you have Republicans now on the Hill who have told this president he better come up with a reasonable plan or he's in trouble.
All right. Well, let's move on to another topic. By the way, if you're just joining us, you're listening to NPR's News at Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai. And joining us on our roundtable today, Julianne Malveaux, an economist and head of Last Word Productions, Bob Meadows of People Magazine, and Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Let's talk about Stephanie Tubbs Jones. Nancy Pelosi has just tapped her to be the new chair of the House Ethics Committee, even though she's had a few travel issues of her own that have been brought to the public's attention. But do you think this was a good decision, Walter?
I think it was an excellent decision. First of all, she's a former judge, former district attorney. She is an extremely bright young lady. And I think, you know, Nancy Pelosi made a smart move here because she's also made some very controversial moves, such as stripping Congressman William Jefferson of his seat on Ways and Means and Alcee Hastings, not allowing him to ascend to chairmanship of the Intelligence Committee over in the House. So I think this is a good move. I think it's the right person. And believe me, considering that ethics and Congress are sort of an oxymoron, mm-hmm. she's going to be very busy.
So, Bob, Rob, is this a make good on the situation with regard to Jefferson and Hastings?
You know, I don't really want to couch it that way. Sure, everything is politics. We all know that. Nancy Pelosi had to get back and good with the CBC. But, you know, she made three other appointments yesterday. One was a white man, one was a black woman, and one was an Hispanic man. And since none of them were couched in, is this a feel good? Is this a great kind of thing? I don't want to put Stephanie Tubbs Jones' appointment. She deserves it. This is not like it's something just being handed to her. She deserves it. She's worked for this. She's been on this committee for 6 years. So I don't want to put it that way. Nancy was quoted as saying that something along the lines of the Democratic strength is rooted in its diversity. And I think the appointment of Stephanie and the other three appointments she made yesterday just show that.
Sounds like an amen is coming from you, Julianne.
Well, my soror, Stephanie Tubbs Jones.
Oh, she got that.
And that's one of those trips. That's one of those trips
and
that
let
got
me
her
say
in
something.
Trouble, too.
And you know, this speaks to the double standard and the strict scrutiny to which members of the Congressional Black Caucus are held. This, I'm looking at two or three pieces that I Googled. Y'all sent one. They said she took 75 trips in 7 years. That's 10 trips a year. Give me a break. Many of them for the National Bar Association and Delta Sigma Theta. She serves on our Social Action Commission, of which I'm the honorary co-chair. She travels to our chapters to talk to sisters about political empowerment and issues, and no one should be penalized for that. If you gave me a list of everybody else's trips and you told me that, you know, she is high on the list of trips, but she's working with our African-American community organizations, collecting no honorary, this is ridiculous. The one blemish on her record was using a campaign credit card for personal expenses, which she paid back. Now, this is extraordinarily common. Mm-hmm. You know, you open up your credit card, you do, and I'm not making excuses. Everyone knows it's wrong. But when the, you know, ethics folks come in and audit, I would say 80% of them have something where you've got to pay something back. It may be as much as $8,000 as she had, as little as $200 or $300 for which they hung Carol Mosley Brown. It was $300 in mistaken credit card use. So this really speaks to the strict scrutiny that this woman's travel is being looked at so closely without looking at the good that travel does. And if you tell me that 10 trips a year is excessive, I think that's absurd.
All right. See, I thought Julianne was going to say the one mistake she made was going to the AKA convention.
Oh, see, now you don't want to.
You know, you better stop.
You don't want to go
stop.
There. Oh, my God. Listen,
don't start none, Walker. There won't be none.
Let's move on to another topic. The Federal Election Commission says, and I don't know that this comes as a surprise to any of us, actually, that it's going to cost $1 billion between the Republicans and the Democrats to run for president in 2008. Any of you surprised by this?
Not at all. What's surprising, however, is the way that the current candidates, some of them want to eschew campaign finance reform and want to eschew public financing of the campaign so that they can spend as much as they want. What we saw in 2004 with Bush and Kerry was that the Kerry disadvantage was that the Democrats had their convention earlier, stuck with the same amount of money. Kerry really had to take the same amount of money and spread it over more months, and he didn't do it. And I think that's one of the things, among others, that cost him the election. But we shouldn't be surprised about this.
No, I think it's another example of why I believe democracy is dead. I mean, this is obscene. I mean, when you really think about it, it's obscene to have to think about spending upwards of $400 million if you're a candidate to run for president of the United States. And it's all about media. Because that's where the money is going. It's all about having enough money to spend on television commercials and radios. Because that's where it comes down to.
Here's my question. What's the difference between having to spend $100 million and $100,000 and what I'm trying to say? What's the difference between having to spend $500 million and $100 million is what I'm getting at.
I was actually thinking $1 billion is actually just a pretty figure. I mean,
yeah.
It's really irrelevant. When has running for president not been the purview of the rich?
Thank you for clearing that up.
I understand exactly. I knew where you were going.
I couldn't get it out, but that was what I was trying to say.
Absolutely. So I thought to myself, you know, kind of like back in 1979 when Nolan Ryan signed the first $1 million contract in baseball. That figure looks so quaint now, but it was outrageous back then. Mm-hmm. $1 billion is going to be the same way probably. 2012, it'll probably be a very quaint figure.
But there is a difference, because today you would not find certain candidates who were candidates 40 years ago or 30 years ago. They would not be able to run today because they couldn't raise the money. Even in today's election, you have candidates dropping out because they know they can't raise the money. So you have a guy like Evan Bayh from Indiana. You know, Evan Bayh was considered to be a likely presidential prospect. Evan Bayh couldn't raise the type of money he felt was necessary in a race where you have some candidates who are going to raise enormous sums out of the gate. So
but you
I
know
think,
what I think? I think the whole issue of the grassroots campaign still is not dead, although you're talking about most of this money going to media. And what I think is that too many candidates have forgotten about other ways that people have organized. Although Jesse Jackson did not win in 84 or 88, the notion of grassroots, what you're trying to do is reach people. You can reach people through the media, but you can also reach people going door to door. If you do wholesale politics, you know, you're going to have to go to the networks. If you do retail politics, you've got to find, you know, 5,000 people in every state that are so enthusiastic about you that they're going to walk, you know, door to door for months.
Let me jump in and ask you this, because we've got about 1 minute left. What does this mean, if anything, for the potential, underlying potential candidacy of Barack Obama?
Barack can raise the money. I don't think it's a question with Barack Obama's ability to raise money. I think there are some other racial aspects that will kick into play if Barack Obama declares that he is going to be a candidate. So all the drama around Barack, I think, will become real once he becomes a candidate.
Bob, you share that? Bob?
Absolutely. Really? I don't think... I just do not believe. I mean, this country elected George Bush in 2004. I just do not believe they are going to turn around and elect a black man for president.
Well, no, I'm
you know, I don't know
that
about
question.
That either.
Go on, Julie. Go on, Julie. But
what I think is that Barack Obama to date has shown that he reaches people in the way that causes the kind of enthusiasm that he could do. He could motivate the kind of grassroots campaign that I'm talking about. Oh, yes, he can probably raise the money. But what I'm talking about, Walter, you talked about democracy being dead,
our
is taking our
short.
Democracy back.
Okay.
Taking it back.
That's Julianne, thank you so much for ending that very salient thought like that. It gives me an opportunity to say that Julianne Malveau is an economist and president and CEO of Last Word Productions. It allows me to say that Bob Meadows is a writer with People Magazine. And it allows me to say that Walter Fields is the CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. This has been our roundtable. Thank you, everybody, for participating.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Same to you.